Linoleum Knife,
a podcast of the cinema.
My name is Dave White.
I'm Alonzo Duraldi.
I'm a film critic. Who's the better one? Who's better at being a film critic?
What? Why?
It's a contest.
It's not a. Every so often, you turn things into contests that are not contests.
It should be a contest.
It should not be a contest.
It should be a contest of who's a better film critic, who's the better husband, who's fatter. I win that one.
Well, okay, fine. I'm on more podcasts than you, so I win that.
Who's the famous one? That's you. Please.
Relatively speaking, at best.
Come on now. We all know
that I am not famous.
That you court celebrity.
Oh,
and that you
stop it. Oh, brother. No.
You are the film reviews editor for The Wrap.
Yes.
You were the co-host of several other podcasts besides this one. Who Shot Ya? Breakfast All Day. You're the fifth Beatle on Deck the Hallmark now.
Don't forget A Film and a Movie.
And A Film and a Movie, which is also on the Deck the Hallmark /
Bramble Jam
Network.
Yes.
By the way, speaking of networks, Max Fun is part of the Who Shot You Network.
And yes.
You just had a meeting.
Yes.
Any fresh news? Any hot goss?
Nothing I can reveal, but it's nothing bad. It's just about things that are coming up very soon that are very exciting, and we have to plan for them.
We ate lunch, and then I forgot to ask you about the meeting.
Oh.
Do you have anything special to tell me?
No.
No? There's nothing fun or good about it?
No, I mean, it's a cool thing that happens on an annual basis, wink, wink.
Okay.
That, you know, we're just getting ready for how we'll be strategizing to make the most of that annual event on Maximum Fun, wink, wink.
Are you allowed to talk about this even on the level that you're talking about it right now?
Yeah, this much. I can't talk about dates or anything.
All right. I don't even know. Because honestly, I don't even know what you're talking about. Oh, so, brother,
you're
it's
the
fine.
Worst.
I'm supportive, and that's as much as you deserve.
Fine. I'll take it.
We had to start this whole recording over because you didn't get my Book of Love commentary.
It blew over my head for a second.
I started the podcast with lyrics from Book of Love's I Touch Roses, and because that's kind of in my head right now.
Okay. Well, if I were
been in my head for a while.
If I'd been on that wavelength, I would have responded with Endora Medusa.
Okay, well, that's three albums down the way.
Same band.
I understand that. But they were at their best. They were at their peak of amazement.
Were they?
For the first Book of Love album. Yeah. No. Yes.
I mean,
you cannot get better than I Touch Roses and Boy and Happy Day.
I like Witchcraft a lot.
I know you do. I understand you do, and I know why you do, because it incorporates a sample from the theme of the show Bewitched.
Well, that's part of it.
Well, that's all of it for you.
No.
I know how you are.
Oh,
I know what you're about.
There's what you don't know about.
I know what you're about. I had this, I don't know why this happened, but like someone referenced the song Boy somewhere on social media. And I was like, oh yeah, Book of Love. You know, because like that's the band that as you're driving to Austin to see Sonic Youth and the Butthole Surfers, you're still listening to Book of Love in the car on the way.
You say you as though this applied to anybody but you.
No. It applies to me.
You and whoever was in the car with you
and the friends who were in the car. Yes.
You know how it is.
It was 1986.
You know this universal experience that five of us had. Ay, ay, ay.
What I'm saying is, what I meant by that was, you can be real punk in the 1980s.
Still like Book of Love.
And you still like Book of Love.
Well,
you know why? Because they were better than Depeche Mode, and everyone knows this.
I have no arguments here.
Yeah.
I have personal witchcraft memories. That is why I like that song. It is not because it samples Bewitched.
Well, okay, so like, here's the thing. from that moment, this is how weird my brain works. And I guess maybe it's how everyone's brain works. I don't know. Someone mentions boy. Mm-hmm. And then that immediately reminds me of our late friend, Beth Case. Mm-hmm. Beth, who lived for a good chunk of her early life in Texas and who sang What the World Needs Now at our 1997 Dallas fake wedding.
Had a band called She-Haw.
Had a band in Philadelphia called She-Haw. And then who tragically died in 2012 of cancer. Mm. I loved her very much.
Yes.
And it reminded me of this really funny thing that she used to do. So when we were in college in Lubbock, Texas, at Texas Tech in the 1980s, Book of Love came to town on tour. No one knew who they were. They were nobody yet. The right. song I Touch Roses had kind of started getting club play.
Mm-hmm.
Why I didn't go, I don't know. Maybe I didn't quite know what was going on with them yet, but she was there. Beth was there. Little bar they were performing at. After the set was done, you know, the DJ came on and the dance floor filled and everyone was dancing. And the band just was like there to hang out, and they danced on the dance floor with the crowd. And so that next week, Beth came to me and she said, I saw Book of Love and then I danced with them. I was like, that's cool. Like, they still hadn't, you know,
sure,
broken. Made a huge impact on my life yet. From that moment on, every time anyone else in our group of friends said something about something that they had recently accomplished, something important to them, something like, hey, I got an A on my chemistry test, or hey, I just got this job, or whatever, she would wait like two beats and then say, I danced with Book of Love. And this joke went on for decades. Like,
you take your victories where you find
them. No matter what happened, if someone in someone's life, anything they ever accomplished, if someone who knew everyone, if the right people were in the group,
hey, I got a book deal,
she'd say, I danced with Book of Love.
That's a good one.
It sucks when it sucks when any friend dies.
Yes, of course.
But when a really funny friend dies, you just curse the universe all the more every time you think of them. Yes. Because, so that thought was going through my head, that story, that ridiculous thing that she always did.
Right.
And I thought, I wish I still had my old Book of Love cassette from the 80s, but I, you know, don't. I went on the internet and I found a copy of the CD for $2.
Well, all right then.
So I bought it. Shows up like 3 days ago. Took a picture of it for Instagram. And I said, and I captioned it. I said, I touch roses. And that when I do this, they respond by blooming immediately. Well, nothing more to say on the matter. Every old person on my Instagram, everyone who is like over the age of 40 has responded exuberantly to just a photograph of a CD. It's so dumb.
You know your demo.
It's so dumb. I love Book of Love.
Yeah.
That's the end of the story.
What's not to love?
We are talking about cinema, though.
Sure.
This is also a cinematic, that story about Beth has a cinema connection.
Oh.
Well, in 2012, when she died, I had not heard from her for a while. She was like that. She would dip in and out of your life and then pop back in and say ridiculous things. And
tell you that she danced with Book of Love.
Yeah. And so I hadn't heard from her in a while. Mm-hmm. And I went to see the press screening of the Richard Linklater film, Bernie.
Mm.
And in Bernie, they talk about how the panhandle of Texas is just the worst. Well, Beth was from Pampa.
Ah.
Beth grew up in the panhandle. Mm. And so I get home and I'm like, oh, I'm OMG, you have to see Bernie. And the like email bounced back. And I thought, oh, damn it, Beth, like I have to go hunting for you.
Yeah.
So I went hunting for her and read the obituary. And it was, I was devastated. And I was like, I was so angry. I was like, you didn't even tell me you were sick.
Right.
I'll kill you.
Well, that's how some people, you know.
Oh, I know. Oh, trust me. I know.
Yeah. Some people reach out and some people shut it down.
So, anyway, not to end it on a bummer there, but, you know, Book of Love.
There we go. Nice save.
Let's discuss the current cinema.
Let's.
Or rather, let's discuss a film that we keep not talking about because I hadn't gotten around to seeing it because it was so difficult to get to see.
What's that?
Minari.
Ah, yes. Oscar nominations came out this week and Minari had them.
Like they it did. It did a little bit of a trial run opening in December and with the like a qualifying run and then I think it was like Film Forum or Film at Lincoln Center had a you had to buy a ticket for a special time.
Yeah, and they would
to
only
watch it on
sell
the internet.
Certain number of them.
And then they would sell out and it was sold out for you know, like weeks or however long they had it. You couldn't get a ticket. And then finally, streaming.
Yeah.
So I streamed it. Finally. Just in the nick of time, because now it's nominated for all the Oscars.
Yes.
How many?
A bunch. I don't know. I don't have it in front of me. But picture and director and
Steven Yeun
and the... Grandma lady.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she's been in like several Hong Sang-soo films.
Oh, okay.
She was in Right Now, Wrong Then.
All right.
And a couple others.
I think she also either won or was...
She's been around forever. She's done all kinds of stuff.
Right, right. But she either won or was the runner-up at LAFCA this year as well.
Oh, really?
The actress being Yoon Yoo-jun.
Yes. So, yeah, it's nominated for, you know... Many things.
Many things.
And it is the fourth feature from Lee Isaac Chung. Now, I haven't seen his other three movies.
Nor have I.
Although, one of the people in this film, Will Patton, is in one of his earlier features.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
This is a semi-autobiographical story of Chung's own...
Childhood.
He grew up on a farm in Arkansas.
Yeah.
With parents who were immigrants. And so this is the story of a husband and wife, played by Steven Yeun and Yeri Han. They have two kids, Alan Kim and Noel Cho, play the children. Slightly older daughter, 6-year-old boy.
Yeah.
And they have left a life of sort of difficulty in California, where the parents were working in a poultry factory, determining the sex of chicks, which I didn't know was a thing. But
I think sexing is the actual verb.
Yeah. I learned that, that this is a job.
Yes.
From this film. And they decide that rather than doing that forever, life is not great. They came to the United States, and after 10 years in California, they realized there's not much going on for them.
Right.
So the father decides, I'm going to buy a plot of land in Arkansas because it's cheap, and we're going to go there, and we're going to make a farm. We're going to grow Korean vegetables there. Mm. Which is actually a really great idea.
Yeah.
Because if you went there and you were just growing, you know, vegetables that white people in Arkansas want to eat.
There's competition.
There are other farmers doing that same thing. Do the thing that no one else is doing. Corner the market.
Yeah.
In your, you know, state of Arkansas. And so, but it's rough. You know, immediately they get there and there's a tornado. Yeah. And I spent the whole rest of the movie wondering, did y'all build a tornado cellar after that event? Because I don't think the film gave it to me.
That trailer's looking real precarious.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's the part I forgot to mention. They live in a big trailer.
Yeah.
Trailer home. And as a person who has spent time living in a trailer park as a child, I can tell you, they're not sturdy environments. They leak and they blow in the wind. And if there's a big wind, they get lifted right up off the ground. So it's, you know, what I'm trying to say is don't move to Arkansas and live in a trailer.
Was that an old Far Side cartoon? It was a trailer park and it had like the little, you know, the wheel of numbers of like how many days since the last tornado.
Right. I don't know. I probably. Yeah. So, and life is still difficult for them.
Yeah.
When they get out, even after the tornado, you know, they dig a well, it goes dry. The grandmother comes to live with them, because they, you know, they feel like they need that support. They are, well, the wife, Monica, she is very religious, and her mother, the grandmother, is not. There's conflict there. They hire, or maybe not hire. It's weird. Like, Will Patton comes to work on the farm. We can't tell if he's being paid or if he's just volunteering. But he is even more religious than the mom. Mm-hmm. In fact, he is, she is a reserved evangelical. He is a wild
carries the cross by the road evangelical.
He carries a cross down the road on Sunday and speaks in tongues when he feels like it. And the more Pentecostal charismatic.
Say, capital C charismatic.
Yeah. So there, that's an element of conflict within the family and clearly also with the children who get dragged to church and, you know, people are staring at them. They are the one not white family in this little church. So there's this, you know how Southern Christian white people are.
So curious.
Yes. So, then some bad stuff happens.
Yeah.
I'm not going to spoil the plot. But it leads to increasing conflict between the parents, whose relationship is, it feels more like a business partnership at times than a mutually supportive one. And the tension between them grows.
Yeah.
The children are observers of this, although the film is not especially from their point of view.
No.
It
shifts.
It
constantly
moves in a sort of omniscient way where everyone is being observed by the camera. It's not like, oh, this is a six-year-old child's understanding of the world.
Right, you know? And then all the scenes are from his POV, not
right.
all.
And ultimately, it is about the conflicts that life throws at you and if you can weather them.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly when you are the outsiders in a place that is very insular.
Right.
And feels on one hand like freedom from your old way of life, but in reality has given you a new set of troubles.
Right.
To deal with. And you kind of learn, you know, well, you can leave a place, but you're just bringing all yourself with you.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very warm-hearted, a very sort of tender film. Clearly, there is, a generosity from Chung about these characters because mm-hmm. they are based on his own family.
Right.
And the experiences they had, in Arkansas in the 1980s. That's the film is set in the 80s as well. If, in fact, honestly, if I'm going to be like critical of anything, I feel like it is so gentle and so kind a film that it maybe pulls punches on what a Korean family would have experienced in Arkansas in the 1980s.
No,
in rural Arkansas.
Sure, yeah.
So
we're not talking metropolitan Little Rock here. We're talking the country.
Yeah. I can't speak to that about that. I can't speak to that experience, but it feels like, listen, I do know white people. I know rural white people.
We grew up around them.
I know Christian rural white people. I know what they're about.
Yeah.
So that's the part that made me think, really? It was that lovey from the neighbors? But again, I trust him to tell me his experiences.
Sure.
Yeah.
Is one of those things where I don't know if it's because I didn't see it at Sundance, where people were first just like
rapturous
about it and loving it and giving it great reviews.
Yeah.
And so maybe my expectations were out of whack, but I saw it and I was like, this is good. This is nicely done. There's some nice performances here, but it didn't blow me away.
Okay.
I think Steven Yeun is good in this, but it's a role that doesn't give him nearly the shades that he gets to play in, like, Burning.
Okay.
You know, where there's a lot going on with that character that you have to sort of slowly peel back and figure out, you know, what the deal is.
Right.
You know, there was another film last year that was, it was a Netflix movie called Tiger Tail. That was also about a couple emigrating to the United States.
Yes.
And, you know, just the grind of work to stay ahead and trying to figure out, you know, like trying to find community and all of that stuff. And I thought it was a much more, I mean, to me, it resonated more with me as somebody who is a kid of immigrants.
Yeah.
Like it felt to me like a more interesting immigrant story. This one, as you said, is very sweet and it's very gentle and it's, you know, it's the kids and it's the grandma. And I don't know. I'm not mad at this movie.
And she's a very dynamic character in the film. You know, the grandmother.
Yes.
She comes in and shakes things up, and she does stuff in the film that eventually comes back to sort of pull the family together. I won't speak too much about what she does.
But. Yeah, like I like this movie just fine, but I don't get the level of love that it is getting. But if you love it, then more power to you.
I get the love.
You do?
Yeah, because the world is garbage right now. And I think in a time of particular garbageosity.
Yes, and when so much of that garbage is xenophobic.
I just made up that word.
Yes.
And when so much of that garbage is xenophobic, yeah. When the world feels like a walking hell, a film like this feels like an embrace.
Mm.
And this is a story about family loving each other and sticking together and seeing it through. And that kind of consistency, that kind of, you know,
steadfastness.
And the empathy that Chung displays toward his characters. You feel it. You absolutely feel it. It's a sweet, kind-hearted film, I like it very much. Now, do I like it very much from a filmmaking perspective? Formally, there's nothing
bold.
Bold wasn't the word I was looking for. Unconventional.
Yeah.
I don't need a filmmaker to do the Quentin Tarantino thing where you're sort of waving your arms in front of the audience.
Right.
Even as much as I like Tarantino. But there's an independent filmmaking world style of reserve, of, you know,
earnest
understatement.
Yeah.
And this is an earnest, understated film.
Yeah.
Maybe I wanted more statement than understatement.
Sure.
I'm not sure exactly what I wanted, but it felt like as I was watching it, I was getting a very high quality, understated, independent film.
It has that kind of Horton Foote in the 80s sort of thing.
A little bit.
Yeah.
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 Old people, you'll know what we're talking about there. The Trip to Bountiful.
Yes.
Yeah. In fact, much like The Trip to Bountiful, not only does it exist in a rural setting, but it is just shot through with Jesus stuff. If you are of a particular age and you were part of the evangelical world in the 1980s, like some of us were, you will hear Michael W. Smith and Amy Grant singing A Friend's a Friend Forever, If the Lord's the Lord of Them, in the background of one scene, and you think to yourself, oh, how much did that song cost for the film?
I don't know that would get to...
You, that's because you don't know.
Okay.
See,
okay,
you don't know.
Okay.
That song was enormous.
I see.
In the 1980s. You could not go to... like a Sunday evening church or a Wednesday night service without hearing some 16-year-old girl
with a guitar
bringing the special music for the evening
for the young people,
for the youngs. She was going to sing Friends.
Wow.
The Friend song by Michael W. Smith and Amy Grant. Massive. That song, that was the My Heart Will Go On of evangelical Christianity in the 1980s. Anyone who's old enough and knows what I'm talking about, back me up, please.
This might have been before you were involved in the church. Did the American evangelical community try to glom onto You Light Up My Life and make it about Jesus?
Not to my memory.
Okay.
And it is because that song was a big pop hit, even though Debbie Boone very plainly stated it's about God.
Yeah.
I don't have a memory of it being incorporated into church services. I think the reason why...
Too secular?
No. People just sick of it.
Oh, well...
You couldn't escape it.
True.
I
just figured they'd want to, like, if this song's going to be popular anyway, they'd want to sort of glom onto it.
No, here's the thing. Back in the 1970s, when I was a little kid, and my brother was bringing us to church, my oldest brother was bringing us to church, if you were going to hear that kind of music, it was not at church yet. The world of Christian pop and rock music was very much in its sort of embryonic stage.
Gotcha.
Larry Norman was still making records. Second Chapter of Acts was making records.
Right.
And you would hear that kind of stuff at the youth group meeting.
Gotcha. Right? At the lock-in.
At the lock-ins or whatever, yeah. At the Christian coffee houses that were springing up in places that young hippie types would go to, gotcha. A.K.A. my brother and all of his friends. I never got to go to those places, but I did occasionally get to go to the youth group meetings, even though I was only 10. Sometimes my oldest brother would just bring me with him, and I was not, it was not fun to be with all these kids who were like 17, 18 years old, because they were adults.
Of course.
You know what I mean? Like they
had mustaches.
They had mustaches. They were adults, and they treated me like I was 10.
Right.
I did not appreciate that at all.
Please, don't they know who they're dealing with?
I was
a mature adult.
I was a very sophisticated.
You were seeing PG
adult
movies.
I was. All by myself.
Yes.
Jaws. Alone. by myself. So, the co-opting of pop culture by the evangelical church, you know, it really got itself going in the 1980s. That's when you started seeing the "His Pain, Your Gain" t-shirts. Oof. You know what I'm talking about. Because the weightlifters would have these t-shirts that said, "No pain, no gain." Mm-hmm. And suddenly Christian t-shirts were there and using that, you know, kind of thing.
Because if there's anything I love as much as contemporary Christianity, it's bodybuilding culture.
Well, then I've got the power team to introduce to you. You should really get into the power team are just dynamic leaders.
I'm familiar with the power team.
Anyway, that stuff it took a while for that stuff to go.
Gotcha. Anyway,
and it's Amy Grant's fault because she started crossing over onto the pop charts in the mid-80s.
Gotcha.
And, you know, all hell broke loose.
So you're saying Minari gets the details right.
Minari does get those details right. Let's go back to talking about Minari, which is a lovely film that is moving yet very conventionally made. And I don't think there's a problem.
It has 6 Oscar nominations.
I don't have a problem with that. It's not, you know, it's not leaping out at me.
Sure.
It's not going to go with me through my life, probably. But it's the kind of movie that when it gets nominated for 6 Academy Awards, you think, good. Why not? It should be, you know. It deserves Academy Award nominations as much as any other warm family drama that is competently made.
Fair enough.
And conventionally, you know, constructed and photographed and presented to you.
Yes.
It's an earnest, understated, independent film.
Can we be clear about this?
And I like it. I like it more than you, apparently.
Yeah, and again, I don't dislike it. I think it's perfectly fine. And I think if I had...
At what point did you decide that you hated Minari? Why do you hate this film so much?
No, look, frankly...
What's wrong with you?
As the kind of relatively safe movies that get Oscar nominations go, I would much rather see it go to a small indie production, you know, where the, you know, most of the key characters are not white.
For sure.
You know, yes, more of this, please, by all means.
Why don't you... Okay, so here's what's up. 3 films we're talking about this week.
Okay.
Minari, Cherry, and The Inheritance.
Oh, okay.
So.
I've seen one you've
we
seen.
We have both seen Minari.
Yes.
And now we're going to bring field reports from our experiences with other films. Now, I've seen more of Cherry than you've seen of The Inheritance because I was sitting here at the dining room table while you were watching Cherry and mostly rolling my eyes at what played out across the screen
I think,
paying bills.
Yeah, that's a valid response.
I did not feel like watching it, and I now know why, because I've seen enough of it.
Yeah.
But why don't you explain to everybody what this is?
Sure. So Tom
Hines... Other than 2 hours and 20 minutes long.
2 hours and 22 minutes.
Sorry.
Tom Holland... plays a guy who we see, you know, going to college, falling in love. The woman that he's in love with seems to, you know, be ready to move on. So he decides to join the army. It's the early 2000s, so the war is happening in Afghanistan. She changes her mind and comes back, but it's too late. He's already agreed to go to the war, so he goes to the war. And that is a psychologically and physically, you know, scarring occurrence. And when he gets home, he gets addicted to opioids, and she gets addicted to opioids. And so then he's robbing banks so that they can pay for their habit.
And she is Sierra Bravo?
She is Sierra Bravo.
Okay. She's been around for a while. Started as a kid actress. Has done a bunch of stuff since she was, you know, 12 years old.
So, yeah, so she and Holland are lifers at this point, even though they're both pretty young. And, you know, this is directed by the Russo brothers who did, like, you know, the last two Avengers movies yes. and stuff. And clearly they are ready to sort of cash in their kind of cultural chits, yes. you know, of having just made two of the highest grossing movies of all time. I'm sure everybody was like, what do you want to do? We'll bankroll it. And they wanted to do this. It's an adaptation of a novel. And they're doing it for Apple TV Plus. So they're getting Apple money for this. And
a chit, by the way, C-H-I-T, is a yes. is a small voucher that one trades for something else.
Yes.
Like a green stamp of the olden times.
Exactly.
Yes.
It's not very good, unfortunately. Tom Holland and Sierra Bravo are quite good, and they commit to the material, and they are...
Jack Rayner is kind of fun, too.
Jack Rayner is fun. Is like the he's like, if you took...
His character's
like
name...
Every, yeah,
his character's name is Pills and Coke.
Yeah, that's what they call him, and that's the only thing he's ever referred to as. He is like every awful James Spader drug dealer rolled yeah. into one. There's... Or rather, somebody who watched every awful James Spader yeah. drug dealer in the 80s and decided that
that's what I'm going to be
he
now,
was
going to
emulate that.
He's got... At one point, he has on two Lacoste shirts.
Almost all the time, he has on two
okay,
Lacoste
I guess
shirts.
I missed those other parts. But he has on two, both of them with the collars popped up.
Yeah. So yeah, they're certainly acting, you know, the heck out of this. And, right. and there's a story to be told here, obviously, about how, you know, the young people are sort of sent off to war with specious promises and then not taken care of when they come back.
There's a very serious minded film that is meant to be what this isn't.
Yeah. I mean, they've got the blueprints for one, yeah. but it is excessively stylish in a way that is really distracting. And much of that style feels like it was borrowed from other movies about either war or addiction. So it feels like, oh, okay, they've seen Apocalypse Now, or oh, yeah, that's a train spotting moment. And so it just it ultimately feels so inauthentic because the movie making is so... It wants to call attention to itself, but then when it does call attention to itself, all it's showing you is stuff you've already seen.
It's heavy on style.
Yes.
And distractingly so. As we were just talking about a film that is so understated that you don't know what the style is supposed to be.
Right.
This is a film that's so loaded with style, the humanity gets lost.
Yes.
These guys make big movies now.
Yeah.
Big movies. And this is a small human drama presented as a big opera.
And the thing is, like, you have to remember, they started out doing very small kind of indie stuff. You know,
and,
like...
you know, Community, right? The TV show,
even,
right?
Even before that. I mean, yeah, they did a lot of episodic, but they started out with, like, that movie Welcome to Collinwood.
Okay.
You remember that one?
No.
You know, it was a early George Clooney comedy from, like, 2002, before Clooney was really Clooney.
Okay.
You know, they did You, Me, and Dupree.
Yes. I remember that.
You know, so, like, they have this background that was very kind of, like, shambling, easygoing indies. And then, yeah, they did a ton of episodic. They directed a bunch of episodes of Happy Endings and Community and, you know, stuff like that. And then, so, like many of the people who wound up making Marvel movies, they were TV guys who were willing to, you know, do the work of fulfilling the studio's vision, you know, like the with the exception of maybe like Taika Waititi doing Thor Ragnarok, most of the Marvel guys have been kind of functionaries, you know, because the Kevin Feige is the auteur here and everybody else is just sort of serving that. You know, if you're Edgar Wright and you've got big ideas about Ant-Man, they fire you.
Right.
So the Russos, you know, obviously handled a million moving parts between Captain America Winter Soldier and or Captain America Civil War and then, you know, Avengers Endgame and Infinity War, whatever. So they can handle a massive production, but they were never stylists, you know. They were never, you never talked about a movie being Russovian, you know.
Correct. Yeah.
But they're trying to be stylists in this one, but all the style they have is borrowed.
Yeah. Footnote. James Gandolfini's son, Michael Gandolfini, is in this film.
Really?
Yeah. If you watch the film, you notice a young man who looks like he might grow up to look like James Gandolfini. Well, that's Michael Gandolfini. He looks like his father.
There's a Wahlberg in this movie, but I don't know if he's one of those Wahlbergs. Although he is from Boston, I don't know.
Of the Boston Wahlbergs.
Of the Boston Wahlbergs, exactly. Yeah, you can skip this one. I mean, I think, like, Tom Holland, bless his heart, is doing the thing that kid actors most often feel like they need to do to be taken seriously as adult actors. And we're going back at least as far as Jodie Foster here.
Right.
You know, I think her role in Taxi Driver sort of set the template for every Disney girl who wanted to be taken seriously as an adult actress. Like, you know, they're going to wind up at Sundance in a movie where they play a sex worker, most likely one also dealing with, you know, addiction issues. And that's just sort of become the stepping stone of like, hey, I'm not just, you know, the adorable Moppet from that sitcom you used to watch. And Tom Holland is obviously wants to have a post-Spider-Man career. And I think he could have one. I mean, he's not the problem with this movie. He's really good in it, I think. And so, yeah, I between this and Chaos Walking, it's been a tetchy couple of months for his films. But, you know, again, neither of those movies are his fault.
It's never the actor's fault.
No.
Unless the actor's the executive producer.
Or they're really terrible.
So I watched The Inheritance.
Yes, tell me all about it.
Well, it's being released by my darling, my Grasshopper film distributors. Film distributors. Grasshopper
in
films.
The tank for Little Grasshopper.
That's right. Now, do not get it confused with another film from 2020 called The Inheritance.
Oh, okay.
Do not get it confused with the big Tony-nominated play, The Inheritance.
Also that.
There are currently three things in the culture right now that have the name The Inheritance. One of them is a play. One of them is a thriller starring I don't know who. But this one is a little movie from Grasshopper. It is the first feature by Ephraim Asili.
The thriller stars Lily Collins and Simon Pegg.
Oh, does it?
Yes.
Okay.
But that's not what we're talking about.
That is not the one we're talking about here. This is the first feature from Ephraim Asili. He's made a lot of short films before this, but this is his first feature. And is it narrative? Is it a documentary? The answer is yes. It is both. It is this wonderful mingling of film of narrative feature, fictional narrative feature, and documentary. It is about a group of young black artists and activists in Philadelphia who come together to form a collective in a home that has been inherited by one of the young men. And there are a couple of jazz musicians who live there, a young guy who plays the trumpet and who always wears sunglasses, and he kind of talks like this all the time. It's really wonderful. At one point, someone in the film says, "When's Miles Davis coming back in?" So they turn the house into a collective for revolutionary activism and study. In fact, they turn the living room into what they refer to as the Revolutionary People's Reading Room. And they have a big, you know, conference about it around the table, and they have to reach consensus. And people are like, it's the living room. Are strangers just going to come in and sit down and read books in the living room? And everyone says, yes, they are. That's fine. And so there's a lot of funny interaction amidst the black revolutionary discourse that takes place throughout the film. There's also a lot of funny stuff about what a drag it is to have too many roommates.
The whole communal thing sounds good until you have to share a bathroom.
Like arguments about like we're a shoeless house, you know, and people who, you know, on another day at another time would be, you know, strict adherence to the revolutionary principles of why we're a shoeless house. One of the young women is just tired that day and she doesn't want to deal with it. And so she walks in, she's wearing her shoes, and everyone says, shoeless house. And she's like, I don't want to deal with this today. You know? So it's this very real, you know, story about what it is to be young and committed to, you know, the liberation of yourself and of the people around you. And at the same time, occasionally butting up against, you know, the rigor of revolutionary life.
Yeah, idealism and practice.
Yeah. So so there's that element of the film. That's the fictional stuff. And it's based on Aseeli's own experiences living in a house like that. Obviously, it is also connected historically to the Philadelphia MOVE organization.
I was about to ask.
And that story is woven into this film as well, not just with archival footage, but with surviving members of the MOVE organization who come in to the film, come into the house and talk to, you know, the actors who are, you know, playing characters.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So, like, real-life people from the MOVE organization, including a couple of poets, Sonia Sanchez, who I did not know about, but Ursula Rucker, who I did know about, they are in the film as well, and they are invited into the house to speak and to give readings of their poetry. Then there's this whole other layer of it, which is documentary. Lots of archival footage of the MOVE story about Shirley Chisholm, about all sorts of, you know, black revolutionary activism that took place in the 70s and 80s that informed, you know, the actions of the characters, the fictional characters who are here in the story. And then you enter the kitchen and there's a huge poster on the wall for Godard's La Chinoise. And if you've seen La Chinoise,
yes,
which is about this very thing,
right,
but young white
Maoists
in Paris, you realize, ah, okay. And then you start seeing characters reading books in bed.
A favorite of the new wave.
Yeah. So this is a wonderful movie that has so much going on and is made for approximately 37 cents. Like, you can feel the budget, but that just adds to the sort of, you know, wonderfully shaggy quality of everything going on. I think this is really great. And it's the kind of film that someone like me, who is middle-aged, queer, and white, who is not fully versed in everything the film is giving me, because so much of what it is giving you are shots of books, albums, films, lots of film posters on the wall, lots of film posters on the wall for films like Ralph Bakshi's Coonskin.
Oh.
Yeah. And other, you know, black-themed films of the 1970s that may or may not have been especially thoughtful or revolutionary on their own.
What the kids might now call problematic in some cases.
Yes, yes. But the La Chinoise is the one that you keep coming back to. And, of course, all the Godard in this film is what you notice. So yeah, you know, an audience member like myself, furious note-taking of cultural references that I either knew and haven't explored or didn't know at all and, you know, would like to find out more about. So it works on many levels. It works for different audiences in different ways, and I think it's great.
So it's showing in virtual cinemas. If you go to grasshopperfilm.com, it will take you to another site called Projector without a final O.TV, right. And it'll show you all the theaters you can choose from. Perhaps you could rent it from Acropolis here in Los Angeles, which is a cool...
Do they have it?
Yeah.
Acropolis has it?
Okay. Which is a cool organization that brings films to town that otherwise would never get here. But, you know, if there's a local theater that you want to support, you know, get it through them.
And I just also don't want to mention, as an antecedent, Godard, because there is the Spike Lee influence here as well that I was also noticing a lot. There's that.
All right. We have letters.
Do you have a DVD pick of the week?
Do I have a DVD pick?
Well, I do.
Oh, I do too.
Y'all actually should watch Les Chinois.
Well, there you go.
And let me see. I've got one of those in my notes. Where did I put it? I've got to pull up my notes. Sorry about that.
I will do mine because it is, I believe, out today from the Criterion Collection at long last. Celine and Julie Go Boating.
That's right.
It's on Blu-ray.
Finally, after all these years.
It has never been available on DVD or Blu-ray in North America before. And it is one of our favorite movies. We love it so very much. And now you can... It's been on Criterion Channel for a while. But now you can own it. And I recommend that you do because it should be in your library. It's a great, great movie.
Tuki Buki is now on a Criterion Blu-ray as
correct.
Well.
Yes, it
which
is.
Which I talked about back last year.
Yeah, I think when it premiered on Criterion Channel.
It was on Criterion Channel. It may still be on Criterion Channel.
I think it is.
Tuki Buki finally has
a physical
Blu-ray from Criterion. It's a 1973 Senegalese film about two young people who want to leave Senegal and go to Paris. And they're going to get there by any means necessary. It really was a shake you up kind of a movie at the time. It had this very jumpy energy that was not common in much of African filmmaking before then.
So new wave influence.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And fun fact, the filmmaker, Jibril Diop Mambéty, is the uncle of Matty Diop, who made Atlantique a couple years ago.
Yep, which is also great, and on Netflix.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Tuki Buki on Criterion Channel and on HBO Max.
Oh, is it really?
In their TCM section.
And on Netflix, Atlantique is known as Atlantix.
Atlantix, yes.
Yeah.
If you look up Tuki Buki on IMDb, it shows you the English title, Journey of the Hyena, which sounds like a Disney nature film. That's a terrible title.
It was, I didn't know that it had an English...
The poster they show says Tuki Buki, so I don't know. Maybe in Britain or something.
Journey of the Hyena? I don't even understand.
The heck of okay. I know. Maybe it's a literal translation of something that's a metaphor or something.
I do not know.
And just to mention real quick, also out from Criterion this month is Defending Your Life, which is one of my favorite Albert Brooks movies.
Okay.
We have a letter.
Yeah, we got a letter from Stephen. Good evening, David Alonso. Allow me to start by saying how thankful I am for your podcast.
Oh.
You've been great companion. Is this just going to be all like...
There's a...
Telling us how nice we are?
No.
Because I
know you get very uncomfortable with that. There's other things being said.
Okay. You have been great companions to be on road trips, quiet evenings at home, debriefing from a busy workday, and especially quiet time for self-care during the past year of stress, disconnection, and isolation. I want to underscore how important your presence in our environment is. A queer couple whose relationship has stood the test of time. That's because we're old as time.
Yeah.
Two fathers' time.
Beauty and the Beast.
Who are creative, compassionate, funny, and vulnerable. We need as many voices like yours to represent the best and most genuine aspects of who we are as queer people. Thank you.
Very true.
That's very sweet. I just can't.
Take the compliment.
I will. Thank you, Stephen. Anyway, he's going to continue here.
Yes.
I have listened intently to the dialogue about Nomadland. Ironically, I was listening to your review of Nomadland while I was driving across the desert between St. George, Utah and Mesquite, Nevada. Wow. It was the perfect setting for the discussion. I listened to part two of the discussion this evening when one of your listeners so adeptly revisited your review of The Rider. Hearing the second part of this discussion, particularly Dave's very honest discussion of how his experience influenced his experience of the movie, I had a realization that I wanted to share. I offer this not as a rebuttal, but as an addition. I think the more perspectives we can share from each of our worldviews, the easier the world is to understand. I will start off by saying Dave's perspective is completely understandable, certainly because of how his lived experience necessarily highlights the way we punish those experiencing poverty in this country, leaving them no choices. It reminds me of the line in Little Fires Everywhere when Kerry Washington says to Reese Witherspoon, "You only had good choices." Some of us, the rich and well-resourced, only have good choices, while those experiencing poverty and disenfranchisement do not have the same good choices, and not because they do not work hard or are any less deserving. So I want to approach this from a slightly different angle, the angle of choice. Those who lived nomadically due to poverty, as Dave suggested, did not choose this. They were forced into it. I would make a similar argument for Frances McDormand's character. While it was not poverty that forced her into this choice, I would wonder whether her lack of choice was related to the destruction and chaos that was thrust upon her after the loss of her partner, her person. I live a life which has been marred by multiple painful sudden losses, and my experience of grief does not let you choose how to grieve. Oh, sorry. My experience is that grief does not let you choose how to grieve. It often presents a series of painful choices from which you must choose. What may once have been a loving, warm, comfortable house may now seem dark, unwelcoming, and teeming with intrusive, painful reminders of what was and what could have been. Loss changes the complexion of things. Those objects or places which gave you the most joy often become radioactive after loss. Grief can also be disorienting. It can steal every bit of breath from your lungs for as long as it wants. Much like someone who is actually suffocating, you do things that don't make sense to others out of desperation and out of a very human need to soothe yourself. So while from a resource standpoint, she may very well have had the choice, perhaps material things, a roof over her head, or typical comforts, had no power over her grief. She didn't choose to experience a heartbreaking loss any more than those experience poverty choose their situation. So while they arrived in the nomadic life out through different circumstances, I wonder whether they ended up there for the same reason. They were forced there as a result of things outside of their control, things that were too amorphous and overwhelming to tackle when all of their energy was focused on survival. Perhaps living nomadically was her only choice that allowed her to cope with her pain. Thank you for taking time to read this. I hope I did not join the conversation too late. I think this is a discussion which is so important for so many reasons. I wish you both and all your listeners the very best. Stay safe, healthy, and most importantly, connected. Thank you, Stephen. You're right. You're right about everything, Stephen.
I love our listeners so much because there's so much awfulness in the world, when especially just people who want to talk about movies can be terrible.
Right.
But our listeners are
You great. Especially are very, I'm very awful. Terrible.
No, our listeners are great. And that was very, I appreciate the things you said about the show. But look, I'm always touched when people say that this show has helped them get through the pandemic. Believe me when I say that doing this show and having it as a regular touchstone and a thing to do every week, this show and all of our Patreon shows.
Yeah.
That's gotten us through this pandemic in a lot of ways. I think that's been a real sort of stabilizing force for us. And so thank you guys for being remotely interested in our, you know, jibber jabber. But anyway,
I'm sorry, you're the one who does jibber jabber.
I'm sorry.
I deliver
foo-for-raw.
I deliver thoughtful thoughts about thinking thought cinema of thoughts.
Okay.
Just so you know.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Well, when you start getting that intellectual on me, I don't even know how to respond. Anyway, but no, all very valid points. And yes, thank you for sharing that with us.
Thank you very much, Stephen.
So,
and all of y'all. Really.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you for being here. And speaking of our Patreon, we do have one.
It's true.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife. Lots of extra content, several extra shows, monthly events, all kinds of things. So go check that out. Patreon.com/linoleumknife. Thank you for listening. Check out our friends on the internet. Go see what Bibbs and Whitney are up to over at the Critically Acclaimed Network. Listen to The Schmoes Know, Anyone with Dennis Hensley, The Comics Canon, Sewers of Paris, All Things Cozy, Deck the Hallmark, The Workroom, Big Fat Gay Podcast, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this show for free at Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, please leave us a 5-star review. We'll certainly read it on the show. You can also leave us positive feedback in the many places that
we stream.
If
it's 4 stars, we're not going to read it.
No. Let's be very clear about
you need to know that.
You can also leave us positive feedback in all the places that we stream: Spotify, Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, CastBox, Podbean, etc. You can follow us on the social media at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you, Blue, for our wonderful theme music. Go follow him on Twitter at Blutopia, BLEUTOPIA. And if you are like Steven and you have insightful, wonderful things to say, drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. And next week, I will be talking about Zack Snyder's Justice League, which Dave doesn't have to watch. But
I don't, and I won't.
I had to, so.
Not interested. Not one bit. Ready? Actually, I did watch, like, chunks mm-hmm. as I walked through the living room.
Yes.
And mostly, I heard it. Because the press screener had no captions.
Mm-hmm. Well, it did. I found them about 2 hours in. I discovered where they were.
Well, you didn't turn the volume down any time.
Well, by that point, it was moot.
Oh, no, it was not moot for me. I sat in the back bedroom in my comfy reading chair.
Cowering in fear.
And hearing a lot of whoosh, whoosh, ah!
Don't hurt yourself.
I just did.
All right. We'll be back next time with more. Until then,
goodbye.